Is it the most contagious respiratory virus? It's highly contagious if you're not vaccinated.
Right. Measles is highly contagious, and it's usually the poster child for contagiousness. From a particle standpoint, the reason is that measles is a respiratory emission, respiratory droplet, that once it's in the air, it stays suspended in air. So if you imagine sunlight coming in through a, you know, through an afternoon window, and you can see the little motes of dust kind of floating, and they'll stay floating almost indefinitely until they come into contact with something. And that's the size that measles is. So if I cough at River Center Mall and those particles aerosolize, they're going to stay aerosolized, and they're going to drift their way down the concourse and down the escalator and out the front door and stay infectious to others who were nowhere near me when I coughed. Whereas with things like influenza or, you know, COVID, if I cough and you're more than 2 or 3 feet away from me, or if I've got a mask on, you're fine, because those heavier droplets are going to hit something. They're going to fall to the ground. Not measles. Measles is going to stay airborne for hours and hours.
I'm Holly Waymont, and this is Pediatrics Now, cases, updates, and discussions for the busy pediatric practitioner. Today, we're talking about the measles outbreak. Authorities in 15 U.S. states, according to the Washington Post, have reported around 36 cases of measles as Florida continues to deal with a localized outbreak in an elementary school, prompting experts to sound the alarm about insufficient vaccination rates in some communities. Joining me here in the podcast studio today is Dr. J.B. Canty. He's one of the few doctors in the country who's double board certified in neonatology and infectious disease. He also has a master's degree in public health and is a contributing writer to Redbook. Dr. Canty, thank you so much for being back on the show today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
One pediatrician was saying to me the other day, you know, it's really tough to be a pediatrician right now. We have so much coming at us. It's really stressful. And here's another worrisome disease that, what would your advice be?
So I first that everyone who's practicing on the front lines in a patient facing outpatient role right now has my deepest sympathies because we've continued to squeeze the amount of time that pediatricians have with their patients, and while we're piling the demands on. So I get it. I think that as much as possible, you know, vaccines are highly effective, and they're very much fire and forget. So if you have a family that's open to vaccination, that follows, you know, this, you know, ideally the recommended schedule, or as best you can do with your particular patient population, once they're vaccinated, it becomes something you don't have to spend a lot of time on. You don't have to do a lot of expectant management for whooping cough, or how long is, you know, the chickenpox rash going to be around if they've been vaccinated back in infancy. So both in terms of doing what's best for the patient and the family, but also protecting your valuable time. Obviously, vaccines are a cornerstone of well care for pediatric patients.
And we'll have an episode in our new podcast, Pediatrics Now for Parents, and that's pediatricsnowforparents.com, that you can tell your patients about. You might not have time to talk much about this in the exam room, so it's one less thing you have to cover in the exam room. So as we know, measles is highly contagious. Do you want to talk about how contagious that is? And should pediatric practitioners be doing anything extra to protect themselves and their staff in clinics?
Sure. So measles is sort of the poster child for contagiousness of all of the bacterial and viral pathogens. It has a reproductive number. So the mathematical models of infectivity and epidemic potential use this concept of reproductive number, where if one person's sick and they're surrounded by a lot of vulnerable people, on average, how many people will they get sick? And measles has one of the highest reproductive numbers at 15. Mm-hmm. So that means within 2, 3, 4 generations, you go from 1 to 15 to 225 to 3,000, you know, within a few days of contagious spread within a vulnerable community. So It's incredibly contagious. It is generally the first one that's going to appear. So if you're practicing in a community or a region that has dropping vaccination rates, usually measles is going to show up first. It's going to show up before we start to see chickenpox outbreaks. It's going to show up before we see mumps outbreaks. It's going to show up before rubella, just because it has the highest reproductive number, the highest contagiousness. Secondly, it's super contagious because it's airborne, just like varicella or tuberculosis. If someone's in your waiting room with a fever and a cough and a characteristic rash, they are spreading that virus to all the cubic feet of air that are in connection to your waiting room. So if you have a sick side over there on the right and a well side over here on the left, it won't make a bit of difference. My long running, and I apologize in advance for the image, my long running joke is, you know, having measles is like trying to separate a swimming pool into a peeing side and a non-peeing side. Like, it's going to communicate really quickly.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. That's a great visual to think about. And it also sounds so scary. It lives in the nose and throat, and the rash may not show up for 4 or 5 days.
That's right. So people are going to be contagious for a few days before they are overtly symptomatic with what we would recognize as measles. So by the time that child is sent home from school on a Friday, they've probably been aerosolizing virus into the classroom for at least 1, 2, maybe 3 days. So, and again, if they're clustered in a community or even in a school or even in a classroom, you know, to go down to the most granular level where other children are also not vaccinated because of, you know, shared parental beliefs or shared religious beliefs, those kids are all almost certainly going to get measles because it's incredibly contagious. And we're seeing that play out in Florida right now. We've seen it play out time and time and time again over the last 10 or 20 years.
And I know pediatricians, our listeners, are highly frustrated with the low rates of vaccination. Some have talked about only accepting patients who are vaccinated, but is that the answer?
Yes and no. It is certainly effective. If you make vaccination a requirement for your clinic, that's going to significantly decrease the chances that you have to deal with this at the provider level. It's certainly not the answer from a public health standpoint. As much work as it is, we have to continue to make efforts to reach these vaccine hesitant parents, provide them with as much information as we can from a site that, you know, from sites that they trust as much as possible to try to win them back. And the American Academy of Pediatrics has used the terms historically of vaccine refusers and vaccine hesitant parents, as if, you know, dividing them into two groups. The vaccine refusers have made up their mind and they don't particularly want to engage in debate. They don't want to seek out new information. That ship has sailed. The vaccine hesitant parents, which are by far the bigger group, are open to listening to a trusted healthcare provider, learning more about the risks and benefits, and then maybe ultimately vaccinating their child. And the problem is you have 10 minutes, 15 minutes to get to all these things. And one of the things we've tasked primary care docs with doing is sorting out who's a vaccine refuser and who's a vaccine hesitant. And there's nothing more frustrating than spending multiple visits on a family only to find out that they were vaccine refusers all along. So the rest of the public health community at the, you know, national level, at the state level, I think at the school level, although that's obviously quite contentious, other people besides just the frontline pediatrician need to be advocating for vaccines, because there's just not enough time in the visit, not enough time in the day for one person to get a family all the way across the finish line.
And we don't, of course, have exam rooms where one side is the vaccinated patients and the other unvaccinated. Would you want to say, you know, a couple of lines to arm the pediatricians who are so busy, who are listening, to say to patients? I mean, should we be saying things like, your child could die if, you know, your child isn't vaccinated for the measles? There is a chance that your child could die, or is that too harsh, or what would you recommend?
It's so hard. I'm nodding my head as you're setting up the question. I have stood at the bedside in my infectious disease capacity of patients who have gotten meningococcal meningitis and they are neurodevastated. Perhaps they've lost limbs and they were old enough to have been vaccinated. Certainly, you know, whooping cough, COVID, you know, influenza to a much lesser degree, because that vaccine is historically not been as protective. You know, it's more of a coin flip with the flu vaccine, but, you know, certainly there are many diseases that we have very effective vaccines for that are life-threatening. And even after the children have gotten these diseases, the parents are still vaccine refusers. So in my, you know, and I'm only one person, so collectively my experience is fairly limited, but in my experience, the "but your kid could die" argument tends to come across, even though it's 100% true. Sometimes parents who are vaccine hesitant or certainly vaccine refusers are going to see that as fear mongering. And for some reason, it's okay for the other side to fear monger, but it's not okay for us to do it. So my recommendation would be, especially if you've got a vaccine hesitant family, is, you know, treat them like a skittish animal, you know, be calm, be consistent, try to be positive and kind of get them to, you know, coax them towards your side. So things like, I know the reason that you are vaccine hesitant is because you want to do what's best for your child and you're not sure what that is right now. So let me talk to you about the benefits of vaccine, the safety profile. You know, some of these vaccines go back decades and decades and decades. We have millions and millions and millions of patients with robust safety data to the point where we know pretty well what the exclusions should be. We know that it's not safe to give live vaccines to a patient who's got a really compromised immune system. We know that it's not safe to give the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis vaccine to a patient who's had a neurologic reaction to it in the past. The flip side of that coin is we know that it is safe for literally everybody else. And so 99% of the time, the safest thing for that kid and that family is going to be to get vaccinated. And if we can just be consistent and positive and try to provide them with objective, good, vetted information to counteract whatever they're hearing elsewhere in their lives, I think that's probably the best bet, because the "you have to get this today or your child is going to die" tends to push people away as much as anything.
And a baby in particular could recover from the measles, but then the virus could be dormant and come back in a terrible way.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's certain viruses that will stay latent or quiescent in the body and then reemerge later. The herpes viruses are the classic examples. So a child can go through varicella and hopefully have an, you know, uncomfortable but otherwise uncomplicated course, and then 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years later have zoster or shingles, and that can reemerge in some uncomfortable places. It could also emerge in some really dangerous places like the eye or the mouth. So even if children have an initial contact with those viruses that they get through, they're still at risk for things down the road. And that could be recurrent infection. That could be cancer in the case of hepatitis B or human papillomavirus. That could be definitive end organ damage that they don't recover from, as in the case with measles. If measles gets to the brain, which it does rarely, but in a very well-reported way, that encephalitis, those neuronal cells are gone. They're never coming back. And so you can get a vaccine after the fact, but it doesn't change the fact that part of your brain is now missing. So, and again, even me saying it in the studios, it comes off as fear-mongering, but
it's true.
But it's true, right? So there's both the immediate benefit and there's the long-term benefit. There's the certainly the protection from cancer. You know, if we had a vaccine for other types of cancer, we had a vaccine for lung cancer or skin cancer, people would be snapping it up at hot dog stands. But we have a vaccine that has been proven to prevent cervical cancer. We have a vaccine that's been proven to prevent liver cancer. And it's an uphill slog to give, to get families to do this because of the weight of misinformation or sometimes outright disinformation that's on the other side of this issue.
And which one prevents liver cancer? I didn't know.
Hepatitis B vaccine. So babies who get hepatitis B vaccine and therefore do not get hepatitis B in infancy, often from mothers who are infected, have a dramatic, let me say it the flip way. Babies who do get hepatitis B infection in the peripartum period and early infancy are at very high risk for progressing on to liver cancer.
Mm. But if they get the vaccine, then they're
protected.
So, and we think about patients, you know, what parent in the exam room, if there was something they could do to prevent brain damage in their child, would that parent not do everything he or she could to prevent that?
Exactly. I mean, the risk of subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which is the, you know, the aggressive brain version of measles, is about 1 in 1,000. Well, if you take all fender benders, you know, all motor vehicle collisions, and you total up the risk of severe traumatic brain injury in children, it's about 1 in 1,000. And yet somehow wearing your seatbelt is widely accepted and the MMR vaccine is not, even though the math works out almost exactly the same. So a lot of it's just framing. I think, you know, we need to do a good job of banging the drum of the safety of vaccines, the proven efficacy over decades. You know, this isn't something that came out last week. Decades and decades and decades of both scientific studies to get them to market and then post-marketing safety surveillance. And so we need to do a better job of touting the benefits of vaccines from the rooftops. We also need to do a better job of framing our discoveries in a positive way. So one of the classic examples for pediatricians who are maybe a little bit earlier in their careers is when the original rotavirus vaccine came out. It made it through phase 3 trials. It was safe and effective. They released it, and once millions of babies started getting it in post-market surveillance, that's when the risk of intussusception was identified. And what did the FDA do? They immediately pulled that vaccine, they retooled it, they worked on it for a couple of years, and now there's a new, well, I say new, new, you know, the last, you know, 15, 20 years, we've had the new rotavirus vaccine that's as effective without that risk of intussusception. So is that a failure of vaccine research? No, absolutely not. That's a huge success story. They got a product to market, they learned something about it, they took it off market, they fixed it, they put it back out, and that problem was fixed. So, you know, when Toyota recalls trucks, you know, it's always framed as bad news, but that's the way the system's supposed to work. We're supposed to continue to strive to make these things as safe as possible. And they're very, very, very safe now, but the post-market surveillance, the vaccine adverse event reporting system, all these tools in place to make sure that it's as safe as it can be, those are all strengths and not weaknesses.
Should our pediatrician listeners be on high alert looking at the symptoms for measles while there's no specific treatment, as we know?
Yes, for a couple of reasons. One, the health department, the public health arm really needs all eyes open for this as MMR rates drop lower and lower and lower, because it's coming. You know, we've already seen some measles activity in Texas. We've seen some mumps activity. We are certainly not out of the woods, and the vaccine rates are trending the wrong way. So yes, the health departments are going to need our help to identify cases. And we have to remind ourselves, most of us have not seen measles. You know, most of us, it's been, you know, certainly rubella, mumps. These are diseases that have been suppressed for the bulk of the current practicing pediatrician's career. So we've got to remind ourselves, what do these symptoms look like? You know, the initial prodromal symptoms, the cough, the runny nose, maybe the red eyes, and then the appearance of the characteristic rash that spreads from head down to the trunk. And once we've seen it a couple of times, we'll all remember, but it's been, even for me, an infectious disease, it's been years and years and years since I've seen a chickenpox case or a measles case. So on one hand, we've all got to stay vigilant. On the other hand, we have to dive back to our textbooks and look up these old pictures from the 1980s, 1990s about what some of these things look like. So it's a tall order, but unfortunately, we've got to get ourselves ready because it's coming.
And if a child has that rash, should the child not be in the waiting room?
Yes. If you have that's a good point. If you have a child with suspected measles, either because they've been exposed and now they're calling to make an appointment at your clinic, or if they come into the waiting room with fever and cough and your receptionist or your medical assistant notices that they've got a maculopapular rash, get them isolated as fast as possible. At a minimum, pull them into an enclosed examination room and put a medical surgical mask on them if you've got them. Ideally, they would be placed in airborne precautions, meaning a negative pressure room where the air from that room is not allowed to circulate to the rest of your building or the rest of your practice. And people who come in to see them should wear N95 masks to prevent inhaling those measles particles. A lot of outpatient facilities aren't structured to maybe have those resources, but at a minimum, try to put them in a room, close the door, and let the health department know that you have a suspected case, and they'll help you with what testing needs to be done, what instructions need to be given to that family to help minimize spread. Mm.
So, and in rare cases, even though we're vaccinated, in rare cases, someone can get the measles, or can we safely say we're protected? We'll have that N95 mask on?
Generally, people who have received 2 doses of the MMR vaccine or who have had measles in the past themselves are considered immune. There are rare case reports of people with 1 MMR dose having a breakthrough infection after an exposure. But if we've had 2, you certainly the younger half of our population right now, if they've been vaccinated, should be pretty protected. But we also don't want those, again, those particles can float. So when we're going in, even if I'm going in by myself with my N95 mask and I'm confident that I'm immune, I open the door. And guess where those particles are heading now? They're heading down the hallway. So I cannot overstate how infectious measles is. And we should take every precaution that we have available to us based on the architecture and geography of our building to minimize that exposure.
And if I'm vaccinated, I still should wear the N95 mask. Don't walk in without it because...
That's right. Theoretically, you are protected, but if you are the 0.001%, we want to protect that. And also, we don't want you to inhale those particles and then transmit them by exhaling when you leave the room, which sounds crazy, but that's how infectious measles can be.
Wow. And according to the Washington Post, the vaccination rates are at an all-time low at 3%, which is actually huge. The Washington Post says the percentage of kindergartners whose parents opted them out of at least one state-required childhood vaccination rose to the highest level yet during the 2022-23 school year, 3%, according to the CDC.
Oh, wow. I thought it was even higher than that. So, yeah, yes, it's certainly the lack of coverage is continuing to rise. And we weren't perfect at baseline. Some children can't get the vaccine because they have concomitant illnesses like, you know, cancer or organ transplant. Some parents are hesitant. Some parents are on a modified schedule. So even at baseline, our rates aren't perfect. And now between the disinformation, the misinformation that's out there, the increasingly politicized split between vaccine acceptors and vaccine refusers, if you look across the country along, you know, kind of red, blue lines, urban, rural lines, you can see some of these splits continuing to emerge. Our rates are continuing to drop. And again, based on the reproductive number, we can calculate the level of herd immunity that's necessary to keep all these different bacteria and viruses suppressed. And generally, measles is going to be the one that shows up first. So the situation in Florida right now is both acutely bad for those children and for those communities and for those pediatricians. It's also the canary in the coal mine for the other vaccine preventable diseases that are going to start to rear their ugly heads in the next few months, next few years, if our vaccine rates continue to drop.
So if things don't turn around, we have listeners, most of our listeners are in the United States. We have listeners around the world. But if things don't turn around in the United States, measles is coming, will be everywhere.
Measles will start, let's take the worst case scenario of MMR rates continue to drop, a lowering tide sinks all boats, right? The MMR level continues to sort of slowly but steadily drop across the country. What you'll see is more pockets like we have now, more communities with the lowest vaccine rates start to have outbreaks. Right now, those outbreaks are contained because generally those communities, those school districts, those, you know, cities are surrounded by larger areas where the vaccine rates are still high. But as the vaccine rates come down, you'll start to see those outbreaks connect to each other and turn into local epidemics, turning into regional epidemics. And it is theoretically possible that if the vaccine rates get low enough, you could have sustained transmission and you could move to what's called endemic disease, which is what, you know, what we remember from our childhood with my childhood with chickenpox, where someone always had chickenpox any given day of the week because it was just being transmitted constantly. And once you have uninterrupted transmission, even if it's not in massive numbers, but if you've got uninterrupted transmission, that's endemic disease. And once we are back to having endemic measles, that will have undone decades and decades and decades of public policy work and public health work. We'll be right back to square one.
As a dad and a doctor and all of your wealth of knowledge with infectious disease, how worried are you?
So as a professional, very. And I think if COVID had not come along when it did, this would have been the dominant topic in pediatric public health over the last 2 or 3 years. We were dealing with measles in 2018, 2019, and it's really just been that COVID pushed it from the headlines. It's not been that measles activity has decreased at all. It has not. So from a public health standpoint, from a professional standpoint, I think it is going to be, along with social media and with firearm safety, I think it's one of the big three things that we struggle with in pediatrics right now. Selfishly, at a personal level, not that worried. My kids are immunized, and I would wish that protection for everybody, because not everyone's kids can be vaccinated. So those of us who can, the families that can, need to get vaccinated to protect children with leukemia, children with weakened immune systems who literally can't get the protection that those vaccines offer. And so our job is to get ourselves vaccinated and surround them in a cocoon of protection and safety, because they can't protect themselves.
And would you recommend every pediatrician listener say something, however short, about the measles to every patient if possible right now?
Yeah, again, I think it's important. I think it is right now, you know, now that the COVID vaccine is widely available and safe and approved for children, I think right now measles is the one that's probably going to become the next biggest issue. So again, pediatricians, if you have time, I know it's a fast 15 minutes, but if you have time, or certainly if the parents have questions for you, it's a valuable thing to spend time on. As the MMR vaccination rates continue to decrease, we will certainly see rubella again. And I think we're probably only a few years away from seeing cases of rubella in the United States, cases of pregnant women getting rubella infection, and that rubella being transmitted to their babies, resulting in blindness, deafness, and heart defects the way it was in the 1960s. So measles, you know, for most kids is just a very unpleasant way to spend a week. It's fever, it's rash all over the body, very similar to chickenpox, although the characteristics of the rash are different, but it's fever and rash and feeling miserable and curling up on the couch. But for one kid in, you know, 500, one kid in 1,000, the virus can attack the brain and cause encephalitis, where it literally destroys the brain cells. It can cause pneumonia. There can be a lot of rare but very, very serious complications of the measles. And on an individual basis, it's the equivalent of kind of playing Russian roulette with one bullet in a, you know, 500 chamber gun. The odds are in your favor. But when you apply that to 4 million U.S. children being born every year, and the, you know, almost 80 million children under who are teenagers or younger, those numbers add up in a hurry. And so if we get to a point where vaccine rates are low enough, it's not a matter of will it be bad or will it not be bad? It's a matter of hours.
That sounds scary.
Yeah. And then from a mathematical standpoint, when we're trying to model how these things are going to, how these outbreaks or epidemics or, heaven forbid, pandemics are going to play out, there's an equation, and this is usually where people tune me out. There's an equation that uses what's called the reproductive number, which basically assumes if you took the whole population of Earth and shook us up and randomly distributed us, and one person is sick, how many other people will that person infect? And measles has a very, very high reproductive number of about 15, as opposed to, you know, 2 or 3 for flu or COVID, or maybe, you know, 1 for a disease like the stomach flu, which is passed person to person. So, you know, one person being able to infect 15 people, those 15 people will then infect 15 each of their own. So now you're at 225, and those 225 will affect 15 people. So within 3 generations, you've infected an entire town in Texas, you know, so it's very, very quick.
Well,
everyone knows the story of the Iditarod and the dog sled races. No one remembers why those dogs were doing that heroic effort. People don't remember the polio days. People don't really remember the measles or rubella days. Even I, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, and I, you know, that era is a dim memory at the beginning of my childhood of chickenpox and things like that. So as a result, when those aren't daily threats to our children, they sort of fade back to the back of our priorities, right? We're trying to get kids to school. We're trying to get all the shopping done. We're trying to, you know, make sure they're staying safe online and make sure they're staying away from, you know, firearms. It's not a clear and present danger like it was 20, 30, 40 years ago, but it can be, and it will be again if our vaccine rates keep dropping. And so even though it doesn't seem like it's the most immediate thing to worry about, we have to, you know, unfortunately use outbreaks like this, epidemics like this, to remind ourselves that we're only a couple of, you know, months or years of poor vaccination away from being right back in the mix again. And that's going to be really frustrating to have to deal with all those things that we thought we had defeated.
Dr. J.B. Canty with the University of Texas Health Science Center and University Hospital, thank you so much for being here on Pediatrics Now.
No, thank you.
I'm Holly Waymont, and this is Pediatrics Now, cases, updates, and discussions for the busy pediatric practitioner. Click on the link in this podcast for free credit that may include CME, MOC, or ethics credit, depending on the topic. Our website is pediatricsnowpodcast.com. My email address is on there. Please reach out with episode ideas or comments. Thank you for making a difference. I'll see you next time. You're listening to Pediatrics Now. I wanted to mention to our listeners, we are now out on Audible. I'm really excited about that. And we do have our podcast, Pediatrics Now, for the busy parent. We know you don't have a lot of time in the exam room for everything you want to cover. So most of the topics you hear about here on Pediatrics Now for the practitioner are also offered in our podcast, Pediatrics Now for Parents. That's pediatricsnowforparents.com or wherever you get your podcasts or on Audible. Thank you again to the San Antonio Pediatric Society for inviting me to speak at their recent meeting. In my talk, I mentioned a quote that really stands out. I was reminded of this quote. It's by Charles Dickens from Great Expectations. It was mentioned in a show I was watching called One Day on Netflix. Imagine one selected day struck out of your life and think how different its course would have been. Think for a moment of the long chain of iron or gold, of thorns or flowers that would never have bound you, but the formation of the first link on that memorable day. You are part of that long chain of gold in children's lives. You are making a crucial difference. I know it's hard. I hope that we are giving you information that's helpful and we are covering topics that are meaningful to you. Please email me with episode ideas or comments. Our website is pediatricsnowpodcast.com. Fighting Fentanyl. That's an episode you can find in this Pediatrics Now newsfeed.